A warning before we start. This episode will discuss child abuse and suicidal ideation. There may also be some strong language. This is episode 6 of 150 Days. I'm Teo Peck Suzuki.
And I'm David Forrester.
If you're a new listener, we suggest you start this podcast from the beginning. It'll be much easier to follow.
Our last episode ended in September 2022, with Teresa Fogel making a deal with Children's Services, thinking she would be getting her two girls back soon, only to learn this wasn't going to happen. Now, we need to wind the clock back to July 28th. On this day, at 2:04 a.m., Teresa receives a text from her teenage son, Azriel, the first communication she has had with him since Children's Services took him and his three siblings on June 25th.
Quick reminder if you're having trouble with the names. Teresa's children, from oldest to youngest, are Josiah, Azriel, Rylan, and Everly. Azriel starts his message with an apology. Quote, "Hey, how's it been? I'm sorry for blocking you. It was just so overwhelming," unquote. It's 2 a.m., so Teresa doesn't respond for several hours. She eventually replies, quote, "I miss you. I'm mailing you a letter today. You should get it by Saturday. I love you, Azzy," unquote.
You might recall that Azriel and Josiah were together when they met with caseworker Jason McGackey at the Gloucester Public Library in late June and set all this in motion. Teresa has always believed that Josiah was the main instigator of those events. She thinks Azriel was just following his older brother's lead.
So Jason is telling you Azriel isn't sure if he wants to come back home. He wants to talk to a therapist.
Mm-hmm. So he's requesting counseling too.
Okay.
And that's because he's afraid of Josiah. Josiah's sitting there buying them brand new iPhone 13 and brand new whatever, probably to, like he said in the voicemail he left, blackmail him and buffalo him so he'll keep his mouth shut.
Okay.
Do you think, has that been the dynamic between those two for a long time, that Azriel's kind of scared?
Absolutely.
Over the next couple days, Azriel sends a bunch more messages to Teresa. They all say some version of, "I'm sorry."
His sleep schedule is also erratic. At 3:22 a.m. on July 30th, he writes, "I didn't mean for any of this to happen." Teresa responds about 4 hours later to tell Azriel she loves him and that she's fighting every day to get him back.
At this point, the adjudication hasn't happened, and Teresa still hopes the case will be closed in a week at that hearing. We know that's not what happens, of course.
Azriel tells Teresa he has multiple panic attacks every day and cries himself to sleep. He also says he misses his dog, Arlo, who's still with Teresa. But Azriel also insists he wasn't happy in Gloucester, which Teresa says is a new attitude. She thinks Azriel was fine in Gloucester until he went back to Butler County to see his girlfriend.
Where, as it happens, he was also reunited with Josiah. Before long, Teresa starts getting a bunch of disturbing updates about Azriel.
He threatened to kill himself on August 1st. He threatened to kill himself again, whenever that was, 2 weeks ago. Cops had to come, you know, but the police aren't counselors, and the police said, "Oh, well, he just said those things. He didn't mean them." How do they know that? How do you know that when my sister goes to work the very next day, he's not going to find Troy's gun and kill himself? How do you know that?
Now, Teresa can't see Azriel herself, so she just has to hope someone else is treating this like a priority.
When you say you're going to kill yourself, whether you're just saying it, nobody knows that. Nobody knows if you're going to kill yourself or not. Whether you're saying that for negative attention or whatever you're doing, too many kids have died because they said they were going to kill themselves and nobody paid attention.
So she starts asking the caseworker, "Hey, what are you doing about my son?"
All of this, acting out aggressively, having suicidal thoughts, all of that was shared with the caseworker.
Yes. I mean, you can see the message. The text message that I sent Jason on August 1st where I said, "Thank you for not calling me to tell me my child was safe after you told me that you would. You know, obviously I have to do my own damn investigation because you tell me one thing and then you do another. So I'm glad to know my child's safe, not because of you," pretty much. And then, "What about this counseling?"
This is not the first time we've mentioned counseling. Teresa has been demanding it for her children in no uncertain terms since June 27th, 2 days after her children were removed. And it still hasn't happened.
Jaclyn claims she sent a referral for Azriel to a place in Butler County called Access Counseling. But Teresa is getting suspicious, so she calls Access Counseling herself. And the person there tells Teresa there has been no referral.
Teresa is apoplectic. On August 2nd, she sends Jaclyn an email that reads, quote, "I honestly have never in my life, no referral was sent to Access Counseling by you or anyone at your agency. I spoke to intake myself," unquote. Jaclyn responds a few minutes later to say it may have been an issue with the fax machine, which Teresa does not find reassuring or satisfying.
On August 19th, Teresa sends a long and angry email to a group of Children's Services staff. To give you an idea of the tone, quote, "I will spend every day until my last breath for all of you people to pay for what you've done to my children and for justice to be served," unquote. And she does get a response from Jaclyn's supervisor, Stephanie McDaniel, who tells Teresa she's taking Jaclyn off the case due to their strained relationship.
A week later, on August 25th, Protective Services Manager Barbara Klein finally emails Teresa her case plan. As you may recall, this is the document that is supposed to explain what Teresa needs to do to get her kids back. It's a month late. And Teresa has had no input on it, even though, as Children's Services' own Matt Starkey says, parents are supposed to be closely involved.
The safety plans, the case plans, they're developed in conjunction with the family. It's not a dictated thing. It is developed in conjunction with the family. We need to work with the family to develop those.
So what does the case plan say over and over again that Teresa has to do to get her children back? What absolutely needs to happen for her to demonstrate to Children's Services that she's fixed the problems in her home? Well, she needs to make sure her kids are all enrolled in counseling,
which she has been trying to get the agency to do since they were removed.
Okay, so they're still not in counseling. We asked for two reasons. One, you've been trying to get them into counseling, obviously,
yeah,
from the beginning. Also, looking at the case plan now, the big thing.
Yes,
the big
counseling.
It's hard not to see the irony there, right?
Right.
But the big thing in the case plan is if you want your children back, you've got to get them into counseling. In other words, this is what you have to do.
But I can't get them in the counseling.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I even sent my own intake,
remember that?
Right, I guess the point is, this is what you've been asking for weeks.
2 months.
It's precisely the thing that they're saying has to happen.
Before I get my kids
before
back.
Before you get your kids back.
2 months I've asked for that.
Yeah, so it's...
It makes no sense.
I know.
David and I didn't get to talk to Azriel directly until several months after where we are in the story. Here's what he said.
Why don't you tell us where you feel this all started?
Just take it from the beginning.
The beginning. So, I was down here for a month, okay? And my brother was down here for a week, okay? So, when we got down here, like, we had to move all our stuff in here. Or, we had to move all our stuff in the old house. And then we moved all our stuff. The only problem my brother had was the internet, like... We didn't have no service, but we went, like, the library had service, so, like, if we wanted the Wi-Fi, we could go to the library.
Meeting Azriel was kind of like completing the puzzle. He was the only person we could interview who was at the library with Josiah and caseworker Jaclyn McGacky. Josiah wouldn't talk to us for this story, and Jaclyn could not discuss the case with us because of confidentiality rules. So with Azriel, it was like, finally, we have someone other than Teresa we can ask about all this.
Was anything that Josiah said true?
No.
And at the time, did you think any of it was true?
No.
So,
I didn't want to intervene. Like, I told him, because this is what I told CPS, I told him that I do not want to talk. I don't want to talk to y'all because there's no point in me talking to y'all. It's just a whole messed up situation.
Teo and I spent a while discussing the interview after it was over. We both got the sense that by the time we spoke with him, Azriel had absorbed some of his mother's perspective. not necessarily in a malicious way, just the way kids talk to their parents, parents talk to their kids, and their stories start to wind together. We wondered how much of what he said accurately reflected his thoughts at the time.
On the other hand, he seemed very comfortable with his version of events.
What were you thinking about as you heard Josiah saying these things? I mean, did you believe what he was saying yourself?
No.
So what, how did you, I mean, did what was running through your head as you were hearing him say all of these things?
Like, what is he, like, why is he doing this? Like, what is he doing? Like, there's no reason for this. There's no point. We're going to be able to see our family. We're going to still be able to see our friends. We're going to be able to visit them and everything. Like, there's no actual cause to him being mad.
The more we talked to Azriel, the more he seemed to settle into his own voice. He confirmed Teresa's story without ever just parroting her words. We should note that we interviewed Azriel without his mother present to try to limit any pressure he might feel to confirm her version of events. What he told us matched up pretty well to the evidence we had spent the past several months gathering.
Azriel was also able to fill in some small blanks for us. For example, where did Josiah get the hammer he used to hit Teresa's car window?
He grabbed a hammer from my room that was holding my window up. Like, it was holding my window up because my window was, like, broken and it would, like, slide down. I didn't know why he was grabbing the hammer, but I was still in my bed. And he ran outside, out the back door, and then went up to my mom's car and then started hitting her window with the hammer.
Did you see that, or were you still inside?
No, I was still inside. And then, like, I got up because I heard him, like, hitting the car with the hammer.
In the end, his story was consistent with the evidence, and it strongly supported Teresa's version of the events surrounding the removal.
Let's go back to August 2022 now. At this point, Azriel has been back in Butler County for a couple months, and whatever good feelings he may have had about leaving Gloucester are long gone. He feels guilty about his role in the removal, and he's become estranged from his aunt's family and Josiah.
I'd act out erratically, and I'd, like, punch stuff. Like, I'd hit, like, wood and, like, trees and, like, punch stuff to, like, make my anger to, like, go away because they like, secluded me, and every time I'd, like, get home from going somewhere with my brother or anything, I'd go straight upstairs because I did not want to talk to nobody. I did not want to talk to them. I locked myself away in a room. Depressed. I'd cry every night. I wouldn't sleep. I'd go to sleep around 4 a.m. every night.
Only one thing brings Azriel any kind of relief.
Yeah, smoking weed. That was, like, the only time I could feel something. And, like every time I'd smoke weed, I'd cry and just sit there and cry and cry and cry. And I'd cry for hours at a time and just not stop crying.
Eventually, he begins to express suicidal thoughts to the people around him.
I did want to die. I wanted to die. I did not want to be alive no more. I did not want to be stuck in that house anymore.
Just to give you a sense of how far his suicidal ideation has progressed, Azriel actually has a plan in mind. He has a place and a method picked out. And he apparently tells his aunt all of this.
We know that Jamie called the police. They went out. There's a police report. Did you share this information with the officer?
I told the cops that, because there was, like, five cops outside of my door.
On August 22nd, a few days after Teresa's furious email to Children's Services, the one where she says she won't rest until justice is served, Azriel has a meltdown, and Jamie calls the police.
Yeah, there was five of them. There was five because I was freaking out and I was punching in the ground and I was hitting stuff. And they were like, you need to calm down, you need to calm down. And I was like, what are y'all going to do? And they were like, if you don't calm down, we're going to have to take you to jail. And I was like, take me to jail. I don't care. I don't want to live here no more. I don't want to be here no more. And they were like, why? Can you tell me why? And I was like, I get secluded in this house. I don't get to go nowhere. I don't get to talk to nobody.
Azriel tells them he's suicidal. And they write that at the top of the police report. Still, he doesn't get therapy.
We tried to figure out what Children's Services did when they heard Azriel was expressing suicidal ideation, but we didn't have much success. We do know that a few days later, Barbara Klein of Children's Services emails Teresa to say they're looking into a new placement for Azriel. so taking him out of Jamie's and putting him somewhere else. It's not clear whether this is related to the incident on August 22nd or not. Azrael told us he hardly ever spoke with caseworker Jacelyn McGackie, except for one time when she threatened him with residential care if he didn't stop smoking weed. He says they never talked about the other issues he was having at Jamie's.
We also reached out to Jamie, but she declined to comment for the story.
I think that's a big deal that following that there were no services put in place, because that obviously presents significant safety issues where he could have harmed himself or someone else. If a child is expressing that they're feeling suicidal or they are perhaps self-harming, that is a huge red flag that they are in need of help, like, right away.
That's Krista Butler. She's a counselor with the American Counseling Association. David and I spoke with her because we wanted to get a sense of what should happen, clinically speaking, when kids get removed from their parents.
In a case where there is abuse or suspected abuse, typically it will entail referrals to additional providers who may include counselors. It may include psychiatrists if that's determined to be in need of the child, or if the child has a previous history of mental health needs and have been on medications previously.
It's worth noting that Azrael does have a history of mental health needs. He's been in counseling before.
It may entail referral even to like a physician, like if they haven't seen a pediatrician. I mean, it's typically holistic and it's going to focus on both mental health and physical health needs that haven't been met.
In case you didn't catch it, this is for all abuse and neglect cases, not just those involving suicidal ideation.
I'm really curious to hear their rationale as to why the children weren't in services. It could be a wait list, depending on the community. If there is a lack of providers to begin with, if the providers that are available just are backed up and they have substantial wait lists, sometimes that can contribute to a delay with getting a child into services.
Now, that's in line with other things we've heard about the child welfare system. Everyone is overwhelmed. There aren't enough social supports. That includes counselors. However,
typically when a kiddo is expressing ideations to harm themselves or others, typically that would kind of cause their name to kind of rise to the top of that wait list. And systems that I worked in, if a child is coming in and they presenting with some suicidal or homicidal ideations, if we feel that we're the appropriate level of care, we would get them in sooner.
But September comes and Azrael still has no counseling, even though he's expressing suicidal thoughts, even though Teresa has demanded it over and over again, even though it's written in Teresa's case plan as one of the main things she has to do to get her kids back. But she doesn't have custody of her children right now, so she can't do it. It's up to Children's Services.
Meanwhile, in the midst of all of this, Teresa is still facing eviction from her home in Gloucester. We mentioned this back in episode one, and while we haven't really brought it up since, it's been hanging over Teresa's head the whole summer.
Teresa figures if she gets evicted, what is Children's Services going to think? Then, in late August, her luck actually turns.
You may recall Teresa's friend and neighbor, Mimi Shuttleworth, from episode three. Well, as it turns out, she owns a spare house that no one lives in. It's the home she grew up in, and after her mom died, she's just been holding onto it with plans to fix it up. With the eviction drawing near, Mimi offers Teresa a place to live.
Once she got the eviction, she broke down and said, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, "Don't worry about it. I have a house that I started repairing. We just need to do some work." I said, "Trust me, my house is going to be a lot better than that hole you're living in right now. You will be surprised."
Teresa's landlord agrees to let the eviction remain sealed, so it's not on her record, if she's out of his house by August 31st. Teresa and Tyler get to work fixing Mimi's place up.
She'd go in the daytime and she'd start wiping down the walls and scrubbing floors. And Tyler worked really hard. When he wasn't at work, he'd be there working at nights and on the weekends trying to get everything done. So she's cleaned windows, hung curtains, you know, made it a home now. And every time every day I'd say, oh my God, this house is starting to look like a home again.
Once they've moved in, Teresa sets about preparing a room for Ryland and Everly.
You said there were a lot of things for the girls. What are we talking, like toys, clothes, like what
toys,
kind of stuff?
Clothes, dolls, you know, stuffed animals, a little makeup vanity desk, you know, for the oldest one. I mean, and bookshelves with books. That room stretches from the whole left side of the house to the right side of the house. That's how big that room is. And so a good 2/3 of it is nothing but the girls' area.
Teresa's hoping her girls will be home in early September. Now, as we found out last episode, that's not what happens. But the good news is, while Ryland and Everly aren't with Teresa, they are now with their grandmother, Cheryl, who by all accounts is taking pretty good care of them.
Teresa also gets a new caseworker around this time named Rebecca Imboden. Rebecca is more experienced than Jacelyn. Also, she is a licensed social worker, which Jacelyn is not. And while we're not sure how much of this is due to Rebecca, it does seem like once she arrives, the path towards reunification for Teresa and her children starts to get clearer.
There is that little hiccup at the adjudication, where Teresa thinks she's getting her girls back and then suddenly isn't. But after that, Rebecca comes and does a home study, sees the room Teresa has prepared for the girls, and eventually gives the okay for the girls to spend the weekend with their mom, unsupervised.
The disposition hearing is coming up in mid-October, and it seems Rebecca is setting the stage for the girls to live full-time with their mom again. Though, after what happened at the adjudication, there is always a small shadow of uncertainty. A worry that something might throw Teresa's case off course again. Because if there's one thing Teo and I have learned from the experts we've interviewed, it's that what happens in child welfare cases often comes down to how the caseworker feels about the family. And Teresa is not exactly going out of her way to make herself likable in the eyes of the agency.
In mid-October, shortly before the disposition hearing, David and I finally get to meet Ryland and Everly. They're home for the weekend, and Teresa invites us over.
You knew what it was. You're such a little guy. This is Rylan.
Hello.
My little mini-me. Mm-hmm. That's almost my size. Mm-hmm.
I can very much see the resemblance.
I like that her shoes.
She's a Sour Patch Kid.
Uh-huh.
We wear the same size shoes already.
Oh, wow.
I know.
And just as Mimi said, most of what was the living room has been converted into a bedroom for the girls with bunk beds and lots of room for toys.
That's a lot of stuffed toys.
Oh, yeah, they're spoiled.
No, not at all.
Over here, like all that. Ryland!
That was what, lime juice.
Lime juice. She like just stuck wax in my mouth.
That's
all the stuff I brought from my mom's yesterday in the bags. But on the left-hand side, she's got storage and she's really into science like me, so. We haven't got to do a lot of those activities yet because she got them for Christmas and then we moved.
You
quit. So. Rylan in particular is happy to chat with us. She shows me her collection of crystals, an interest she has inherited from her mom.
You tell them where you got those, Ry?
Sometimes I get them at the crystal store.
But where did you get all of those?
You?
No.
Who?
You don't remember how you got those?
Stole them?
In Tennessee!
Oh.
I stole them.
What? I stole some of yours. Sorry. I was trying to get more crystals.
Well, now I know where some of my crystals went.
Stole this one?
Yep.
From your mom.
Overall, she seems like she's enjoying being with her mom again.
While Ryland and Everly wander in and out of the room, Teresa talks with us about the case. She's clearly glad that her girls are home, if only for unsupervised visits at this point, but the situation with Azriel is still weighing on her.
Azriel has recently sent Teresa a lengthy text message, which she reads to us while Rylan and Everly play nearby.
Hey, I don't know what to say, but I'm going to just say it because I have been thinking about it a lot. But here it goes. Nothing can put into words what I have done to you, Tyler, the girls, and myself. I can't say sorry because sorry don't help anything. I just want how it used to be back, and I want you happy to be able to wake up and smile and say today is going to be a good day. I want you to wake up and look around and say there are no problems. I just want the best for our family, and we all just need time to grow and heal. But I'm sorry for everything I have done, and I know that my love for you and Tyler and my brother and my sisters is all from my soul and my heart. I just want us to be happy, and I know that I can't take none of it back because it already happened, but I would if I could in a heartbeat. And I want to say sorry to Rylan and Everly. I put them through something no little girls should go through, and I can't take it back. I blame myself for all of it, and I know that you're going to say it's Saya's fault, but it's mine too.
The message continues like this for some time.
And Mom, I'm sorry I'm not the son you dreamed of. But you told me no one is perfect and told me everyone has that one moment in their life. And that stuck with me all these years. And I didn't need my dad because you were play both roles. And you did have to do that. But you sacrificed everything for us. And to do what was did, I can't take it back. But I hope you can accept my apology. And I promise that none of this will ever happen again.
Teresa has recently gotten word that Azriel will finally be getting counseling, but not in the way she was hoping for.
You may recall Children's Services telling Teresa in August they were trying to find Azriel a new placement. Well, they found one. It's a lockdown residential treatment facility called Foundations for Living, which houses kids with severe behavioral issues, the kind of place you go when nothing else has worked.
Supposedly, Azriel is sent to Foundations because he wasn't succeeding with a lower level of care. This is according to the therapist he is assigned to at Foundations. The problem is that, as far as we know, there was no lower level of care. He was never provided with counseling. And then, when things got really bad, Azriel was just dropped straight into the deep end of psychiatric care.
One of the number one rules in counseling is do no further harm.
Here's Krista Butler again.
And the potential for placing a child or anyone in an inappropriate placement is that it could be potentially harmful to them and potentially present more challenges than solutions to why they're seeking treatment in the first place. And so I would say the biggest thing is obviously the potential for harm, the impact that this has on this child to end up in a facility that they should have never been in the first place if there was no evidence-based rationale to support why he was referred to it.
According to Azriel, many of the residents at Foundations are from juvenile detention. The doors are locked. The kids are under constant surveillance. The staff monitor their sleep and breathing every night. On top of that, three of the four showers in the bathroom are broken, and the one that does work only has cold water. We're really not sure why this is where Children's Services takes him.
We got Burger King, and then when we got there, we unloaded my stuff. We went inside. She signed me in. I had to weigh myself. I weighed 110 because I didn't eat at Jamie's. I didn't want to eat at Jamie's. They signed me in. They signed documents and stuff, and then I went in. Like, they beeped the door. And then they opened it, and then I walked in, and they beeped another door, I opened it, and then we walked in, and then I went into this room, and they asked me a bunch of questions, like, why do you think you're in here? And I was like, my mental health, basically, like, my depression, my anger issues, my PTSD, my anxiety, and then they took a picture of me.
Rebecca Imboden is the one who drives Azriel to Foundations. She apparently tells him he'll only be there for 45 days. But then when he gets in, the counselor tells him something a bit different.
I was like, how long is this program? Like, how long is the program I'm in? And she was like, I think you're like the same as everybody else. Like, you got 5 months. You have to stay 5 months in here. And I was like, my caseworker told me that I'm going to be in here for 45 days, and that's the least I'm going to be in here. And I broke down and, like, started crying. And then I walked out in the hallway and, like, started crying. And then my counselor asked me when group was over if I was okay, and I was like, yeah, I guess. And then they, like, gave me a bed and everything, and I went to my room. And then I just laid there.
Every day for Azriel is closely monitored and controlled. He gets along well enough with the other kids, but some things freak him out, like the shanks.
When I seen the shank, like, my roommate had it. When I seen it, I was like, what is that? And he like pulled it out. It was like that long, a metal piece that long. And your thumb went like, it like went like this, and like there was two spikes out of it. And like, if you wanted to like shank somebody with it, you could stab somebody, and it'd break skin too, because.
So your roommate showed you this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, right away?
Mm-hmm. As soon as he got it.
Azriel alerts someone to the shank, and his roommate apparently flushes it down the toilet. The showers also took some getting used to.
Imagine taking cold showers for a month straight.
And when you say cold showers, I mean, there was no hot water whatsoever?
Nope.
No hot water?
Mm. Cold showers the entire time. Only one shower out of the whole thing worked. Out of the four showers that were in there, worked.
Wait, when you say work, I mean, you can only get water out of one mm-hmm. of them? So there's only one functioning shower, right?
Like, if you, like, you had to hack it, so, like, you'd have to hit it, like, the faucet thing, and, like, you'd have to turn it a little bit, and then, like, it, like, click, and then, like, it'd come on.
And that was the only shower the water came out of.
Mm-hmm.
It was cold. Cold, cold?
Freezing cold.
Now, before sending him to Foundations, Children's Services did what's called a CANS assessment on Azriel. That's Child and Adolescent Needs and Strengths. It's a pretty standard assessment tool in child mental health care. But there's supposed to be more to putting someone in residential treatment than just a CANS assessment.
Typically, you know, when I would have children go into residential treatment, I mean, there's a whole packet, let me tell you, of assessments and information and a report that we would have to complete before a child would even be considered for even having a meeting to discuss residential treatment.
If there are any other assessment materials for Azriel, we never see them. And like everything else, Children's Services won't comment. Teresa, though, is not pleased.
How many times I said my son said he was going to kill himself, that they would have immediately put him in the children's hospital? No, they didn't give a shit. They didn't do anything immediately. He could have killed himself 500 times.
Teresa cannot understand why Children's Services has opted for such an extreme measure after months of what looked to her like complete inaction.
My mind's blown. And I'm getting him out of here. I don't care what I have to do.
Unfortunately for Teresa, it's out of her control.
Therapy is not supposed to be a punishment. But as time goes on, Azriel gets the sense that how long he spends at Foundations is going to depend on his behavior. In fact, he's apparently told that if he behaves well, then he might leave before his 5 months are up. So he keeps his head down, avoids getting into fights, and does what he's told. Eventually, the roommate with the shank leaves, and he gets a new roommate with whom he gets along much better.
We were both in there for mental health issues, so like, we like could relate to each other, and like we like liked working out and like liked exercising. So that's what me and him did. We like did push-ups every night and sit-ups, and just like got along.
Meanwhile, he just waits.
A week after Azriel is sent to Foundations, Teresa has her disposition hearing. This is where the judge determines what happens to the children, whether they're returned to her or remain in the custody of Children's Services. Teresa shows up to the hearing on October 18, along with a handful of witnesses to testify on her behalf. But it turns out they aren't needed. Children's Services is happy to let the girls go home, and the judge returns custody to Teresa with an order of protective supervision. This means Children's Services will continue to check in on the family. The boys, meanwhile, will remain in the agency's custody for now. Asriel is at Foundations for who knows exactly how long, and Josiah doesn't want to come home. Teresa is relieved to have her girls home nearly 4 months after the removal. But she is still under the agency's microscope because of the protective supervision order. Teresa's first review hearing is scheduled for November 22nd.
In theory, Children's Services is helping parents work through the case plan they've designed with the parents' help. The review hearings, then, are where the judge can get an update on how that's going. Now, in Teresa's case, the case plan has always seemed like more of an afterthought than a genuine strategy for reunification. Teresa says Rebecca doesn't even really bring it up after it gets filed. So the question is, what are they going to talk about at this review hearing?
Once again, we're not quite sure what we should expect. Fortunately, it seems Rebecca has decided Teresa's family doesn't need her services. She's hinting that Asriel might soon join his sisters at home.
When the earlier hearings were happening back in the summer, the adjudication, the disposition, there was a lot of tension and uncertainty. Teresa would wait in the courthouse with her neighbor Mimi and her advocate Becky Falks. And at the adjudication, there were tears of relief, briefly, when she thought her girls were about to come home, followed by anger when that didn't happen. This review hearing in November is not like that. The excitement, the nervousness, that's pretty much gone. Now it's like she's just waiting for this bureaucratic machine to work itself out.
In the end, it all feels strangely uneventful. Teresa goes into the courtroom. A while later, she comes out and says Children's Services has agreed to give custody of Asriel back to her, once again with an order of protective supervision.
Rebecca's going to get him right now.
So they're picking him up, bringing him back home. He'll now be
home.
And you have 6 percent.
I have what?
Custody?
Yes.
And that's it. In total, Asriel has been out of his mother's custody for exactly 150 days. During that time, he's been depressed, isolated, suicidal, and stuck in a residential facility. And now, just like that, he's coming home.
So I got home around 8.
When you say you got home, I mean, this is the first time that you've been home, meaning with your mom and your sisters.
Yep.
What home means. Since June 25th,
yep.
Right? What was that like?
I was so happy. I was so happy to be home. Like, and when I walked in, they already had all my stuff, and Tyler helped me, like, get all my stuff inside. And I got situated. I told my mom what I just told y'all, like, about the residential facility. And then my mom was like, let's go up and see your room. And I was like, okay. And then when I walked in my room, my girlfriend was sitting on my bed.
What a nice surprise.
And, yep. And then when I got, like, I was just happy to be home. But when I first came in, Arlo was sitting in here, and I said, Arlo. And he turned around, like, real quick. And, like, you know how, like, when an army man comes home and, like, he sees his dog that he's had from, like, when they were a puppy, and he was crying. My dog was, the dog out there that's barking, he was crying. It's my best friend. I love him. Like, it was so, I was so happy to be home. Like, so happy. I didn't want to be in there no more.
The first thing Teresa does is enroll him in counseling.
Teresa now has 3 of her 4 children back. But that doesn't come close to making up for everything she's been through since that fateful day in late June. Children's Services has put her and her children through a gauntlet, and in her opinion, without much to show for it. On top of that, her older son is still not coming home.
Critics say this is the sad reality of the child welfare system today. But there are ways of making it better. So what could we change? That's next time on 150 Days. 150 Days is a production of WOUB Public Media. The podcast was written and produced by Teopek Suzuki and David Forster. Adam Rich is the audio engineer. Music by Caitlin Krause and Brad Swinarski. To read the digital version of this story, go to woub.org/150-days.